The Bible is absolutely full of singles, and a moment ago we talked about one verse, and in this next session we want to jump around a little, but to preview the idea that it is full of singles, when you think about, I'm sure that you can think about a number of singles that you've read about in Scripture, and I'm just going to list 5 or 10 here. The Shun single, do you remember the Shun single? That was Hagar, get out of here, you know, she's the one that was always saying to Abraham's wife Sarah, I know you don't have a carpool if you don't have any kids. The professional single, Deborah, the judge. The selective single, Isaac. He didn't start dating until he was about 40. So those of you who are coming to the 30-something, it's good. This scared single, that's Joseph, who had a little action problem with his boss's wife. The swinging single from Genesis 34, Dinah. Remember, she was alone and young and inexperienced, and she created a little problem for immorality, and the result was a destruction of a whole city. So, the singing single from Exodus 15, that was Miriam. She sort of was the cheerleader after they came into the promised land. The sensational single, I guess that would be John the Beloved. The surprised single, that would be the Samaritan woman in John 4. The satisfied single, I don't know who that would, no, Paul in 1 Corinthians 7. The saintly single, that would be Daniel in Ezekiel 14 in the book of Daniel. And then the supreme single that Kelly sang so beautifully about, Jesus, in Matthew 19. And it is exciting that we read about him in John 1:14, that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And he taught us a number of things, how to have for our lives goals so that we're really going somewhere, and how to relate to people as we went. Now, I did want to mention to you before we talk about the relationships, the whole idea a moment ago on the secrets to making an impact. I realized that there's many more than just asking those three questions. And so in your notebook, if you look on page, as far as the personal strategies, if you look at beginning on page 5, establishing your purpose, and then hopefully some of this material you could do on your own about a need for a personal vision. And many of you know the reason for a need for a personal vision. And for instance, if I just walked in your midst tonight and somebody, you were at somebody's place and you were playing darts, and I said, here's a whole handful of darts, why don't you play with me? What would be your first question to me? What? Where's the dartboard? Wise group up here. Or if you walked into a study lounge over at the seminary or at TCU and somebody there is just typing away, I mean, they've rented that computer, they're typing, and then they're printing it out, and they print it out about 25 pages, you go, what are you doing? I don't know. Don't bother. You go, what do you mean you don't know? I just don't know, but leave me alone. And it doesn't matter when I finish because I don't know what I'm doing. We would think that totally insane, but some of us are wandering around in life, even our spiritual lives, and people go, what is your goal? I don't know, but don't bother me, I'm late. So this is the idea here, is to come up with a personal plan. Now, this is not particularly spiritual anymore to have a mission goal in life, is it? This used to be sort of a new idea a few years ago, but now I go into Waterbeds Incorporated and they have mission statement published on it. And you go into Love's to get some gas and they have their mission statement there. So I would think that it would behoove us to figure out where we're going. And these pages will guide you through some goal setting. Page 10 gives you some idea of what your goals need to be. They really do need to be written down. And I would suggest that you just get a file folder and begin to work on it. And as I think I mentioned to you, it took me about 2 years to get mine totally written out. And I went through some of these questions, if you'll look on page 12, questions to start your thinking about your ambitions. I did have an ambition to write a book about college students, and I wrote one, and they shrunk it to a booklet, which is fine. They say that this generation doesn't read, that you're just a viewing generation. And on page 13, this is an excellent process. If you ever have some Saturday morning free when you don't have an early morning date, you might want to just say to your roommate, I don't know, some of you, your roommates just watch TV from morning till night, and you want to declare them legally dead, but you can't probate their will and go on. But just ask them some Saturday morning, why don't you and I go over to the botanical garden somewhere, and you go over there, and I'll go over here, and we'll answer these questions. And then we'll get back together in an hour or two and go have lunch and share some of our ideas together. And I think this might motivate you to begin to figure out what are your personal strategies before you begin to reconsider again, as we're going to tonight, your interpersonal strategies. So if you'll look on page 15, we want to talk about topically some of the ideas. Isn't it amazing, the mystery of human attraction? It continues to puzzle science, puzzle psychologists, computer analysis. They never can figure out what is the chemistry that makes people like to be friends with each other. There are some qualities, I think, that we don't understand about people we're attracted to, and yet there are some principles that can help us understand about relating to one another. I know when I was writing the book, Good News Travels Fast, and tomorrow, I don't know if you're coming back, but tomorrow after the session, those of you who want a copy, I have some in my trunk. But I was trying to finish chapter 3, and I was on the plane of working, and as we were headed for the landing, this gentleman looked over and he saw me close the folder and said, chapter 3, and he said, oh, are you a novelist? And I said, no. He said, are you writing a book? And I said, yes. He said, what's the title? And at the time, the title was Students Witnessing, so I didn't want to tell him. I said, well, how about if I just tell you what it's about? He said, well, what is it about? And I said, it's about how to share Jesus without being really dorky. And he said, well, that'd be nice if somebody could just make him believable. And we began to talk, and he said, what angle are you taking? And I said, relationships. That's the angle I'm taking. And I said, in fact, I have a quote by Alan Bloom. Have you read that book, The Closing of the American Mind? It's easier to close your mind than open that book, I know. But I would encourage you to do it. When they start writing reviews of chapters of a book, you can pretty well know this book is going to be important in this decade. So let's read it. But one of the things that Alan Bloom says in that book is that people today are so isolated in their individualism that no wonder their favorite novel is Camus' The Stranger. You know that? The Stranger, has about three interwoven plots. And so I asked him, what do you think of that? He said, Camus' The Stranger? Yes, I just read that last week. In French. And I said, well, would you agree with that? That the student world is isolated? He said, oh, not only that, but my generation, 25 to 35, we are isolated. I said, well, you don't look very isolated to me. You look very successful. He said, oh, no question about it. I am a success. My parents were successful, and I am successful. But they didn't know how to relate, and neither do I. Though I don't know all of you, I know two things about you. You really do want to love someone, and you want to be loved. And I think we have some principles from this book that can help us do that. So let's look at those. And just, I know that Nothing like relationships can be as simplified as we put on this page. But just to help us remember those, I put them in these eight qualities in an acrostic. R-E-L-A. You know, you can read it. You can spell. And let's look at the first one. R, respect a person's right to be an individual. Now, Romans 12:10, you notice, says, give preference to one another in honor. Now, I'm in no way saying totally die to yourself. I just listened to a tape the other day by Bill Hybels' wife called I Died to Myself and Myself Almost Died. I'm not saying that, students, but I'm saying when you can give preference and honor someone, then do it. I remember one time when a friend came to visit me and we went out to dinner. We had a lot of fun. He was going for an interview the next day. And I looked back in his back seat and I could tell that he'd just taken his clothes out of the laundry and put them in the back seat. And I said, what are you going to wear tomorrow? And his packing looked like controlled wadding. So I said, he said, I'm going to wear that shirt. And I said, well, why don't I press that for you? Well, fine. So I'm in there trying to press his shirt and get all these wrinkles out. And he said, look at me while we're talking. I said, I can hear you talking. You go ahead. I'm just going to get this shirt right. He said, no, just look at me. And I ignored his preference and continued to work on what I thought was important, which was to have his shirt look nice. And in a few moments, he was up around. He grabbed the iron out of my hand. He goes, I will iron my shirt. Sit down and look at me. I mean, how difficult is that to look at somebody? Often I think when we look in people's eyes, we can really see the person and all that's there in the spirit. And we need to learn how to give preference if that's what somebody wants. I know when I was at OU, I had students, upperclassmen, living with me the whole time I was there. And every semester we would move a new group in, and I would ask them to decorate their own bedrooms as they wished, but that we would all decorate the living room. And this one day when we were all moving in, I propped up my favorite painting about a, 24 by I don't know what, thinking everybody must have the same taste I do, and so I just propped it up there knowing they'd want to use it. And but I said to one of the girls as she was bringing a box in, why don't you go ahead and do your room, and then we will decorate the living room together like we all like it. And she goes, oh, that's good, because that thing, she didn't know that was my painting, that thing over there ought to be in a museum. And I wish I could say that the Holy Spirit was so in charge of my life that I immediately responded well to that. I thought about several options. That I could just stomp my foot and go, look, I'm the oldest one. I move every semester. I'm going to hang you. I don't care if you feel like you live in a museum. But, you know, the more I stood there, the more I thought, if I really operate like Jesus, he didn't really care so much about things as he did people. And so I figure I can get myself across that room and get that painting up. And I picked it up. And I walked down the hall with it, and I slid it under my bed, and it didn't break my heart that we didn't use that painting. And it was just a preference she had, and it was okay for me to honor that. Respect a person's right to be an individual. Honor their preferences, just in simple ways. Not only that, but the E is encourage security in those doing well and in those in trouble. You notice the passage there, John 8, 3 through 11, that woman was in trouble. If you remember, that's the passage where Jesus is confronted by this woman that was brought to him, and the scriptures say that they caught the woman in the act of adultery. I do not know what those nice men were doing out there to catch her in the act, but Scripture doesn't elaborate on that, so we won't need to stress the point, but they threw her in front of him, and then proceeded to test Jesus as though he didn't know the rules. You know, he knew she was supposed to be stoned, but he also knew, though he had never had a human anatomy course, that she couldn't commit adultery by herself. And he also knew the truth was that man, according to the Mishnah, was supposed to be strangled. He was supposed to stand in dung, you know, dung, up to his knees and have ropes attached to his, and he was, they were supposed to pull on the ropes until he strangled, and then he could just slide into his, the, what they had him stand in, up to his knees. And they questioned, what do you think we ought to do? And you know, remember he wrote on the ground. It's the only place that ever recorded that he wrote. He never wrote a book, he just wrote on the ground. And some people say that he was doodling just to offend them because they thought they were asking him a very important question. Of course, Mike Warnke, I don't know if you'd consider him a real theologian, but he says he thought they were, he was writing the names of their girlfriends. Whatever it was he was writing, he distracted attention from this. I mean, what if we had caught someone in the act of adultery and one of the ministers of the church drug them down here and threw them in front of you? Wouldn't they be a little disheveled, in shock? And at least Jesus allowed her to get herself together. And then when he said, okay, go ahead, bang her brains out. Whichever one of you has never committed a sin, you do it. And interestingly enough, they all began to leave. And the scriptures tell us that they left the oldest starting first. Have you ever noticed this, singles, that the older you get, the less self-righteous you get? I mean, you're not old, I know that, but... and finally, there was no one there but him and her. But he and she. And I'm sure she thought, okay, now he's going to do it to me. Because he's really qualified. He's the only one who's never sinned. He's probably going to bang my brains. I'll pick up the biggest rocks they drop. And his stand, now he actually said this. He didn't just act this out. He said it. And singles, we need to learn how to form these words for people. Not that we accept their behavior, but that we approve of them. He said, neither do I condemn you. All your accusers have left, and neither do I condemn you. Have you said those words lately to somebody who is suffering? Somebody who's walked off into sin and is ashamed of that or feels guilty? We need to learn to look in each other's eyes and say, I don't condemn you. But Jesus did say something else. Don't sin anymore. It's only messing your life up. We need to figure out how to encourage security in people that are in trouble. Some examples I've seen of this, I know when I was traveling out in Midland, a young man who had led a person to Christ, and then he had him move in with him. He said, you know, you can't believe what happened. After John became a Christian, he moved in. I went on a retreat, and I had $20 lying on my dresser, and he stole it and spent it. And then when he came home from that retreat, John kept trying to get the nerve up to tell him, I stole your money and spent it. And so he waited and waited and waited. He talked and talked and talked. And finally, he just said, well, I just have to blurt this out. I stole your $20 and I spent it so you could hit me. Yeah. Is that the way you guys just handle things? Just hit me and it'll be okay. So Enrique said, okay, stand up. And then he began to pull up his 250 pounds and he started across the room. And he said, shut your eyes. And John had his eyes shut. He said, stand up, shut your eyes. And he got across the room and then he just gave him a big bear hug. And he said, I think I need to do for you what Jesus did for me, which is forgive me when I've made mistakes. We need to learn how not to condemn but to encourage. And not only that, the L is we need to learn to love unconditionally and see things from other people's point of view. And you can see them, most of you probably know these by heart, Philippians 2, 3, and 4, that we're not to look on our own things, but look on the things of others. Now, I think this is totally impossible if we ever ignore God's love for us. I don't think we can love other people unconditionally. Do you? And here's what I see happening to a lot of people today, and a lot of singles. Do you remember the last cup that you drank from? Did y'all have cups out there? I have this cute little Diet Coke bottle in here, but do you remember, what did you drink from out there? Were they, what were they? Plastic cups? Okay, just try to envision the last thing you drank from, and let's assume that that container represents your life, okay? And as you hold your life, God is trying to pour His love into your life. So He says to you, Jeremiah 31:3, I have loved you with an everlasting love. And just before it drops in your life, you go, everlasting? Everlasting? I don't even know everlasting. You know, my mom married and remarried. I don't know everlasting. It doesn't work. So you block that. And God says, well, from Romans 5:8, even when you were misbehaving, I loved you. That Christ died for us even while we were still in our sins. And before that drops in your life, you block it to say, no, you know, people really don't treat me like that. When I behave appropriately, people are nice to me. When I don't, they aren't. And God says in Isaiah 43:4, you are precious in my sight and honored, and I love you. Before that drops in your life, you block it by saying, that seems totally opposite of the way that ought to be stated. I mean, I ought to be saying, you are precious to me, not, and I honor you, not you honor me. Now, if you continue to watch that dialogue, you would notice that that person's life is totally empty of love. And then say that I walk into Elise's life, and I take my empty cup, and I want to try to love her. So I try to pour love into her life, and what happens? Nothing. Because nothing really flows from an empty cup. But suppose in that dialogue you saw a person who didn't block it. And when God said, I have loved you with an everlasting love, you think, man, I don't even know what that looks like, but let's have it. And it goes into your life. And then God says, even when you were misbehaving, I loved you. And you said, well, that's a new number for me too. But let's. And He says, you are precious in my sight and honored, and I love you. And most of you are wearing rings that have precious stones, and they haven't done a thing for you today. You wear them just because they are precious to you. And you figure that, and you think, God, that's wonderful, God. I'm precious. Wow. And you let all of His love fill up your life so much that it starts splashing over on other people. And maybe people say to you, why are you so loving? You go, I don't know. Must be God. I really think we cannot do this unless we let that love splash in our own minds. And what does it look like when we love someone unconditionally? I think it looks like something Jesus did in Mark 1:40. You remember when that leper came running up to Jesus and broke a rule by speaking to him? And sometimes when people in your life break rules, you go, you broke a rule. The man broke a rule, and as he ran up to Jesus, and some of you, I guess, are in the medical field, you could describe explicitly to us, which we don't want you to do, about leprosy. But we in general know what that does, that all the nerve endings die first, and then people can harm themselves. I mean, a leper could put his hand on a stove, and when he lifted it up, he'd go, oops, I burned my hand off. And he didn't notice because those nerve endings are gone. So they sometimes would damage themselves, plus have rotting, running sores. So they had to run around screaming, unclean, unclean. And if we had a modern-day single leper, he would probably have to look through squint holes. He couldn't be in here with you. We just have a squint hole to look through. And suppose that one day you were running around screaming, unclean, unclean, modern day single leper, and you saw one person that could change your life. You'd run up to him. And this leper ran up to him. Interesting thing about him, he said, Jesus, if you would, you could heal me. He knew how much power he had. You know the thing he didn't know? He didn't know if he had enough compassion. And the truth is, there are probably some of us sitting right here tonight who know exactly how powerful he is. But the truth is, there may be something eating away and rotting away in your life. And you're thinking in your mind, I know he's powerful enough. I don't know if he cares enough about me to change this. But the leper ought to give us an indication. Because when he said, for instance, say that Cindy, I just met her and I know she's not a leper, but say she's Jesus and I'm the leper and I go running up to Cindy and I go, Cindy, you know what? If you would, you could heal me. Now, she could say, well, you know what? If you would, you could back up about 40 feet because you're opening up my sinus passages and you stink. He didn't say that, did he? In fact, the scriptures tell us that he touched the leper because probably one of the things other than his health that he most missed was the interaction and the touch of another human being. And I don't think he just kind of looked around for a place that didn't have a running sore and went, be healed. I think that he hugged him, and in hugging him, he healed him. In singles, I think somewhere in our lives, we've got to learn how to love people unconditionally because most of you sitting in here also probably have a modern-day leper in your life. Maybe they work at the desk next to you. Or maybe every time you turn around, you think, they're sewn into my sleep. Where did you come from? You're always there. I think that perhaps we could bring healing if we would just hug those modern-day lepers to our lives. And in hugging them, in treating them with unconditional love, perhaps bring healing. Not only respect and encouraging and loving, but accepting the whole person is important. Accepting their intellect, accepting their personality, accepting their body, accepting their spirit. Now, have you ever noticed this, fellas, when you first meet a girl and you go home and you write 14 letters and the girl goes, she freaks out. Because that's overload for the amount of the casual acquaintance. Or if you just meet someone and... did any of you see Paul, is it? Gary. Did you see Gary at the break? He came running down, got on his knees, and got this plant and handed it to her. But sometimes if you just have one date with a girl and you go, oh, great, why don't we just fly down to Houston for dinner tonight? Well, that is a signal, guys, to a girl. A little too much time and money for a casual relationship. And sometimes we need to figure out what's important in accepting one another. And we need to be willing to accept all different kinds of personalities, even if they drive you crazy. It would help you to know something about the different personalities. Because if you are melancholy, now I remember Beverly Brandon, when she was Beverly Seward, she was in seminary, she lived with me one summer, and since we were close to the seminary, I would try to have someone over every night. And finally, our dear pastor, and one of the, probably one of the deepest, dearest friends in my heart, Harold Bullock, came over one night and goes, Carolyn, I think you're driving Beverly crazy. I said, oh, really? How is that? He said, you have somebody different over here to spend the night every night. He goes, yeah, it's so fun. I think we can just kind of get through a lot of people in the church. And he said, well, I think it would be better if you just stop that. If you want to see them, just go see them. and let Beverly have some calm, some quiet. Oh, that's a thought. But I would never have thought of it. I mean, I thought that was fine with her. Maybe she just wanted a little more space than she needed, but melancholies need some quiet. And, you know, sanguines could use a little. We just never bother with it. But we need to learn what really ministers to different personalities. And we need to learn how to talk with each other and accept that. You know, if you're a casual acquaintance with somebody and you walk into a room and you smell something, you probably don't say anything. Maybe if you're a little closer to them, you might say, is there an odor in this room? And if you're a really close friend, you make a statement. You go, you stink. And if you're an intimate friend, you say, I'm coming by and check to see if you bought deodorant tonight. You know, so it depends. We can accept people and treat them at different levels. And I think that we learn from Jesus probably how to accept personalities that have gone awry. And most of you know the story of Mary Magdalene. And when we meet her in Mark, we notice that it is said of her that Jesus, when he first met her, healed her of 7 demons. Now, I don't know if you have someone like this in your singles group. But obviously, she had what she thought was an impossible problem. I mean, some of you think you have personality problems. I mean, really, what would you be like if you had 7 demons? I don't know. What would your roommate be like? When you walk in, would they just have a dead raccoon in their teeth? I say, what are you doing? I'm just shaking, Mr. Raccoon. I'm in no way trying to have us laugh at the demonic, because I believe it is very real, and I don't think all the demons are in Africa. What I'm trying to get us to see is that it takes a lot of courage to act like Jesus in relationships. It took a lot of courage for Jesus to walk beside her and say, I want to be your best friend. And in his drawing her into that koinonia, her life was healed. And see, you don't know what somebody with 7 demons acts like. Maybe she levitated half the time when he was walking around with her. I mean, if you had a friend who was a modern demoniac, could you take that? And yet he did. And so changed her life as she became his best friend that when he died, remember, she was the first one at the tomb, and she was asking the question, even though she didn't know she was talking to him, where did you put the body? Now, don't you have to be pretty good friends to be checking a body out of a morgue? I mean, you have to be good friends. She was like, tell me where you put it, I'll get his body. And finally, you know, here she had walked to the crucifixion, right? And that's about 50 miles on foot, and I don't think they really had a lot of pavement or blacktop. So she scrambled her way through 50 miles. Now, if you got up tonight and walked over to Dallas, when you go, hey, ho-hum, I'm too tired, I'm not going back over there tomorrow, you'd be worn out. She was physically exhausted. How would it be if you walked over to Dallas and sat down and right in front of you they executed your best friend? So now on her physical fatigue, she adds great emotional distress. And then in this garden, when she's asking, where is he? Just tell me where he is. And in one gospel, remember, she's talking to the angels. Then it doesn't freak her out. But then when she hears her name called, Mary, wouldn't you like to write a paper about the change from the agony she was going through to the ecstasy when she turned around and there he was. There was her best friend. We need to figure out somehow how to accept people like Jesus did, accept the whole person, their intellect, their personality, whatever. And not only that, we need to learn how to take risk. Galatians 6:2, bear ye one another's burdens. Now, let's say
Who do we? Let's see. TK, I met you a moment ago, and you're married. What's your wife's name? Kelly. Yeah, there she is. Okay, now I didn't go there. Did anybody go to their wedding? Let's just assume what it was, must have been like when TK and Kelly got married. And here, maybe here she is back there looking down, and TK is standing at the front of the altar. You know how the guys do, his cutaways and his white tie. And I'm sure that she was back there peeping out thinking, wow, what a package I'm getting. And then he's standing there trying to be reasonably calm when this gorgeous woman starts down in all this white regalia. And he's standing calm and cosmopolitan, but he's probably thinking inside, wow, what a package I'm getting. And so they come together, and the pastor unites their packages, and and they go off to live, and they begin to unwrap these packages. And maybe one day one of them says, hey, whoops, I got damaged goods. The truth is, we're all damaged goods, aren't we? And I think Galatians 6:2 is a great passage for us to look at, to study, to remember. Because I don't know about you, but the greatest burden of my own life is my own damaged life. So for somebody to walk beside me and to say, I know your damaged goods, but I want to bear that burden with you. Let's go. And I think we'll find that in taking risks, we have to do the next step, which is to involve our friends in loving other people. Hebrews 10:24 and 25 says that we should provoke one another to love and good deeds. Now, many of us provoke each other, but not particularly to love. One day I was sitting thinking, how I wonder how I could provoke. I was meeting with about five people. I thought, how could I provoke them to love other people? And I got this idea. Sometimes they're costly ideas, but I got this idea I could go down to the jeweler and I could get these bracelets and have engraved inside the bracelet Luke 21 and 32, which is where Jesus prayed especially for certain people. Remember he said, Peter, I pray especially for you. And so I wrapped them up and I gave them to these people. And I said to the people, the only strange thing about this gift is that you can only keep it a year. And then you, during that year, I want to make a commitment that I will pray especially for you. And during this year, would you look around for one person that you could love and pray for? And when you find that person, you, at the end of this year, you take that bracelet off your arm or out of your jewelry case, wrap it up and give it to that person with this idea, that they would pass it on to one person they would pray for, especially through the youth. And the interesting thing is, I went back to a spot where I had gone, was attending church, and I was sharing a book with someone I didn't really know very well, a younger person. And guess what I saw come up when the person was helping me hold the songbook? It was one of those verses. I said, where'd you get that? They go, oh, you know. And I didn't know who gave it to him, but I knew somebody is involving somebody else in loving someone. And we just need to ask God, give us ideas on how to do that. And then nourishing intimacy, honesty, by communication and commitment and confidential accountability. Interesting thing about Jesus, he thought that friends were so important that he was willing to lay his life down for them. Are you willing to do that for a few? And are you willing to submit your life to a few people that you'll be really accountable to? I was in Colorado not long ago, and this friend came up to me and said, you know, I'd really like us to get together. We used to live together. She said, I'd like us to get together and be accountable to one another about every so often, you know, a quarter through the year. And I said, that's a great idea. You know, I would like you to ask me, when you see me next, Carolyn, did you spend some time on your knees in prayer? And every day did you spend time in the Word? And every day did you spend time working at having a pure heart. And if you didn't have one, did you confess it? And then I said, and I'd like you to ask me a fourth question. Did you lie about any of your answers to these other three? That's what I call nurturing real intimacy and accountability. And then the last principle that we have time for, and fortunately since it's the last one, to give time and attention and a sense of significance. There's another verse that says, and Proverbs 13:12 that you may add there, hope deferred makes the heart sick. I've been telling you some things that worked in my life. I want to tell you something that didn't work. I had a friend that she was on our leadership team, and I'd been meeting with her for a while, and she came into me one day, and she goes, Carol, I just want to tell you one thing. I never want to be like you. I said, thank you, Kathy. What brought that on? She goes, oh, I don't want to tell you. I just want to pray for you. I said, no, and oddly enough, I think really the Holy Spirit gave me, I mean, that doesn't it? Don't you hate it when people don't like you? I mean, I think we can stand just about anything if people don't like it, but I didn't like that. So I got my purse and I got my success diary, and I said, what is it that you don't like? And if I can, by God's help, I will change it. And you just tell me what they are, and I'll work on it. She goes, no, it's just one thing, but I'm not telling you. I said, no, go ahead, and I promise you that I will work on this. She goes, well, oh, okay, I'll tell you, it's just one thing. Have you ever noticed that when you come into a situation, if it's a party or whatever, you by the time you walk across the room, you have said to 9 people, hey, let's have pizza, hey, you want to come over to my apartment this afternoon? I mean, and you can do your laundry, hey, let's go to dinner. Do you want me to come over? I'll help you do your car. I'll help you wax your car. Hey, and she said, you know what? You forget it by the time you get across the room. And they're all waiting to do their laundry and have Cokes with you and do pizza. And I never want to be like that. And I thought, well, by God's grace, I will stop that. We need to be able to give time and attention because it gives great significance to people. And sometimes we don't realize that our words and our lack of faithfulness to carry them out hurt people. And I have really worked that, and I will work at that this weekend. I would like to sit down with every one of you, and if I can find out we can have some time, I want to do it. But I will not say, yes, I'll have a coach. Yes, I'll have dinner, because I think it's pretty well all organized, except for some places. In conclusion, I would say that we as a group can continue to make an impact in our world if we will refuse to be isolated. Now, some of you are sitting there saying, well, I'll tell you one thing. If I start actually making an application of those 8 principles, I am going to have to change. And personally, I just don't like change. Well, that's tough, single. Because Jesus didn't like nails either.